This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The Washington and Idaho legislatures go back into session next Monday. For most of us in our daily lives, this doesn't mean much, except that the laws and policies adopted in Olympia and Boise trickle down to us at home. So this hour, we'll review a few of the issues that will get attention in the two capitals during the next few months, and we'll look at what's on the legislative wish lists of a few folks from Spokane. One issue in both capitals is school funding. Both states are in the process of making change. The Washington legislature voted last year to increase state property taxes as part of its plan to raise more money for basic education. That was to satisfy a ruling from the state Supreme Court, which said the state is passing on too many of the costs of teaching school children to local districts. 2 weeks ago on this program, Washington State School Superintendent Chris Rakedahl explained the reaction to that.
I think the court said to the legislature, you got it done from the perspective of the court. You used the formulas that we said were basic education that the legislature wrote in 2009 and 2010. You did make sure that the state money is now going to cover those formulas instead of locally funded property taxes, but you're taking too long. The court was really clear to say, we had an expectation this would be done in 2018. Your full plan doesn't really kick in until 2019. So we need you to speed that up as much as you can. The court didn't ask for another $1 billion of new money. They said you really got to pull something forward here to satisfy our timeline.
So Washington's legislature will be searching for another $1 billion to spend for schools in 2018. Idaho's legislature has also been putting more money to education during the last few years, much of it to steadily improve teacher salaries. And now lawmakers will be asked to consider a more fundamental change in the way money is allocated to school districts. A legislative committee, co-chaired by Idaho Falls Republican Representative Wendy Horman, has been working for 2 years to evaluate the state's current funding system and to replace it with something that's simpler and easier to explain.
Our current formula was established in 1994, which in Idaho was pre-charter school. The internet was just being invented, so we were, you know, it was pre-online, pre-virtual classrooms. And so there isn't a standard learning environment necessarily anymore, and yet our funding formula is locked into this old structure that thinks there is. And so the homework we've been doing is around transitioning to a formula that's based on students. And so it will have a better chance of enduring, along with bringing us the greater flexibility, transparency, local control that we hope to achieve with transitioning to a student-based formula.
Tell us more about what the legislature is going to be presented with.
The committee got as far as identifying several issues unanimously, and in a bipartisan fashion. We are committed to finishing the implementation of our new career ladder in Idaho, where we will implement year four of that this year, year five next year. So this committee unanimously agreed that we need to complete that investment in teacher compensation. There was unanimous agreement around converting from funding students based on average daily attendance to moving to an enrollment count. We know students frequently attend, you know, a portion of a day in maybe an online charter or their homeschool, or they're homeschooled and they go for band or choir or sports or something like that. So we've recognized that students are receiving their education from multiple providers. And so an enrollment count supports fractionalizing that, as well as moving toward a mastery-based system, which Idaho has some very strong pilots going in that direction. And so as we move to a mastery-based system, we feel like counting based on enrollment and students will better facilitate moving toward mastery. And then we agreed unanimously that we should move to a student-centered funding formula with certain weights for different types of students who have greater needs. Those have not been specifically identified yet, whether that's special education, English language learners, students in poverty. Those will be identified in the coming interim. So this resolution will propose those things. With that said, there were some issues that were not fully researched and decided upon, and one of those was how will we handle local contribution? And so that one will be pushed forward into future discussion next year. But the resolution we hope to present in the 18th session will call for these unanimously agreed upon changes and then establish advisory committees with folks at the local level, folks who work with us on a daily basis, who can help inform us and implement the changes that will be statutory, hopefully in the following session, in a way that supports schools and allows them sufficient time to adapt to the changes.
It sounds to me on the 20,000 foot view, this is fairly major surgery, if you want to use a medical term here.
It will be a big change when we do move to full implementation. But again, we are not interested in doing anything to harm schools or disrupt them in ways that makes this transition, you know, more painful than it needs to be.
When you talk about things like this, it often leads to more money. And in Washington, the issue is more money needs to be spent on public education. Is there also that same mantra in the state of Idaho that we need to spend more money on public education?
There is always that conversation about more money. But the conversation I'm most interested in is how we spend that money. And a lot of the research that this committee was presented with was that when there is that flexibility and that transparency at the local level, there's greater ownership of results. And so to the extent we can bump these decisions down to the local level about how to spend the money rather than the state tying so many strings to it, I think that's just great for everybody concerned. Now, there will be a cost to transitioning away from an attendance model to an enrollment model, and that at last estimate was about $56 million. So we hope to set aside funds this year that will go toward that transition when we actually, you know, change the formula in statute next year. That will lead to holding school districts and charter schools harmless in the transition.
Representative Wendy Horman is a co-chair of the Idaho Legislative Committee that's recommending changes to the state's school funding formula. There are other important issues before the two legislatures. Idaho lawmakers may again take up the repeal of the state's grocery tax. Lawmakers in both chambers approved the repeal toward the end of the 2017 session, but Governor Butch Otter vetoed it after legislators adjourned. Some legislative leaders say they believe the bill will be approved again early in the session, so they would have time to override another veto. In Washington, school funding will again get much of the attention, but water rights on private property will also be an important issue. Republicans want the legislature to act to override a state Supreme Court decision that moved authority to approve private wells for new homes and businesses from the state to the counties. The decision is what is known as the Hearst case.
This is incredibly complex. It's incredibly political. It's very controversial.
This is Kirkland Democratic Representative Larry Springer speaking at a Greater Spokane Incorporated legislative forum last month.
This is a fundamental issue that is inseparable from people who want to just live their lives by building their home on a piece of property and raise their families. What's more fundamental than that? And on the other hand, it is culturally and religiously just as fundamental to our tribal governmental partners in terms of what it means for fish, water, and their way of life.
And Republicans are using their political leverage to force the legislature to reverse the effects of the court's ruling. The Republicans say that ruling has the potential to stymie growth, especially in rural areas where water supplies are limited. They've insisted the legislature change the laws to protect landowners who want to build and dig wells. If that doesn't happen, they say they won't vote to approve a new state capital budget, which includes money for construction projects all over the state. Legislators have held at least one hearing within the last month to try to come to a solution. At that same legislative forum, Senate Minority Leader Mark Schessler said he's open to a compromise.
I think we want to see some cooperation on water resources, and if it means working on some things for fish to improve it, fine, but eliminating eroding property rights in rural Washington really doesn't make any sense when the total amount of water from exempt wells is currently 1%.
In other issues from that same forum,
senators, representatives, in November, the AP reported that more than 170 women had signed a letter sending it to ask the House and the Senate and the Capitol to look at how you handle sexual harassment. Can you give us your thoughts on how you plan to address that issue this session?
The legislators, including Spokane Democratic Senator Andy Billig, said they've already undergone additional training and begun the process of trying to make the Capitol a safer place to work.
Incoming Majority Leader Senator Sharon Nelson has created a task force, and that task force has on it particularly staff members, as well as some legislators, but staff members and lobbyists. So it's not just a top-down solution. So the people who might be the reporters can say, this is a good way for us to be able to report. These would be avenues where we would feel safe in reporting.
Greater Spokane Incorporated has issued a comprehensive list of legislative priorities. The list includes developing a solution to the water rights issues described before and the new capital budget. That budget would include money for new science-based buildings for Eastern Washington University, Washington State University, and Spokane Community College. GSI also supports money for what's known as a Spokane Sportsplex near downtown for local and potentially national sporting events. And GSI supports a move to reform the state's workers' compensation system and to reduce the B&O tax for manufacturing companies, something Governor Inslee vetoed last year. The Spokane Regional Health District has its own legislative agenda. That includes a request that the state raise its legal age for purchasing tobacco and vaping products from 18 to 21.
If you can positively impact youth and prevent them from initiating smoking, then all the data suggests that the likelihood of them taking up tobacco products after the age of 21 is limited significantly.
That's County Health Officer Dr. Bob Lutz. Each legislator has their own pet projects they work on. One we recently told you about on this program involves members of Spokane's Marshallese population. Spokane Democratic Representative Marcus Riccelli is co-sponsor of a bill that would allow the Marshallese and other low-income Pacific Islanders who are not citizens to get financial help to buy health insurance. Because of the mid-1990s federal welfare reform, they're not eligible for Medicaid or other government programs that offer subsidized care. Many of these people suffer from radiation-related illnesses. The Marshall Islands was a testing ground for U.S. atmospheric nuclear tests between 1946 and 1958. Riccelli says that makes it a moral issue for him.
I think some of my Republican colleagues believe this is the federal government's responsibility because it was the Department of Defense. These were nuclear tests. I don't argue that there should be some responsibility at the federal level, but right now my big concern is people are going without health care access. They're letting small things turn into big things because they're concerned about the affordability. And by the way, we committed atrocities to these people, and to provide them premium assistance is actually, in my opinion, one of the very least things we could do.
The Washington and Idaho legislative sessions begin next Monday. We'll cover progress on legislation involving some of these issues on future Inland Journal programs. This afternoon, Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckert will ask his colleagues to override Mayor David Condon's veto of Stuckert's campaign finance ordinance. The mayor issued his veto in a press release last Friday. It came as a surprise to Stuckert, who says the mayor hadn't voiced his concerns to him during any of their conversations over the last few months. The proposal written by Stuckert and Councilman Brian Beggs halves the maximum contribution limits in city council races from $1,000 to $500. It defines when candidates can raise money. Council candidates running in 2019 could not accept donations until this week. Certain entities, such as public sector unions and companies that contract with the city, would face bans or limitations on contributions. Companies with more than $50,000 in city contracts over a two-year period are forbidden from giving money to candidates. Stuckert says for legal reasons, the city can't prohibit union contributions, but it can require those contributions be publicly disclosed. And the measure would have the city monitor donations to candidates. This week, we asked Mayor Condon about his veto.
You know, first and foremost, as a matter of policy, I believe and has been taken up by the state that campaign finance is and campaign disclosure has been at the state level and always has been. So it's a redundant process to do it at the city level. We do not have the wherewithal to do this today, where the state does through the Public Disclosure Commission. And that really leads me to the second reason is there's pending legislation on this. And so why preempt that legislation, allow it to go through? It is a top priority of the new Senate majority. It's a top priority, ironically enough, of our own Senator Andy Billig, who has been leading this. It's passed both houses in years previously. So my presumption is that it would do well in this year. And so rather than creating that confusion, that redundancy, that next level, and so that's number one. Number two is another reason is looking at the issue on the legal respects of treating one group different than the other. And it was commented on from the dais and other places of, in particular, prohibiting donations from business, but not that from organized labor.
Condon believes parts of the ordinance conflict with federal law and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Citizens United case. The mayor says he agrees with the concept of trying to make campaign contributions more transparent to the public.
Unfortunately, and you've seen it in the last couple election cycles here locally, a significant amount of third-party political action committees doing independent expenditures. And so in some respects, I think an unintended consequence, like we've even seen with McCain-Feingold at the national level, you see this proliferation of third parties versus the candidates themselves. I don't know what that magic number is, but I do say that, unfortunately, I think there's going to be some unintended consequences, even if they are well-intentioned, because, quite frankly, the evidence proves that we've seen at this level. So I would hope, as we go forward, you know, if we, you know, debate this more, that we look at some of these issues and predominantly, and as I've read some of the information around the Disclose Act, they've addressed some of these issues, not all of them. I'm not trying to say that the discussion is done by any means, but there are some unintended consequences when you start implementing some of these rules.
Condon says the ordinance would add to the cost and responsibility of city government in an area where it hasn't had authority.
Starting another bureaucracy at the city level is not a priority within city government when you talk about, in my opinion, the public asking about police officers and other priorities, streets, and that this would not be a new bureaucracy I'd want to stand up in lieu of more police officers, better street funding. And this is all general fund dollars, which do compete directly with these other things. I had not received a single concern from memory on this to the mayor's office. And I think there's a general angst about where campaigns are going. I just think it's misdirected having the city come to solve this issue versus it going on to our state agenda.
The city council would need a supermajority, 5 votes out of 7, to override the mayor's veto. It had 6 votes when the council approved it last month. Condon says he would order an outside review of the ordinance and even questions whether it might ultimately be implemented.
For me to implement something that I believe not to be consistent with federal and state law becomes problematic, and so then would we actually implement it if there's these outstanding legal issues?
City Council President Ben Stuckert says his ordinance has been fully vetted by city lawyers. He says the mayor cannot refuse to carry out an ordinance he doesn't agree with. A vote to override the veto could come during a council meeting during the next few weeks. And now a few minutes with Harold Belays, the longtime Spokane artist whose works are found in many areas of the community, from Riverfront Park to the plaza in front of Spokane Public Radio, died last week at the age of 89. Belays was not only a prolific artist, he was also a man with a devious sense of humor. In 2010, on the air with SBR's Vern Windham, Belaise talked about the fun he had making pieces that he would secretly leave in places for people to stumble upon.
I love artifacts. I think it all started, I went to teach a winter quarter at the U, and because the weather was mild for us, we'd go have a picnic on the beach and there'd be nobody there, which was nice. And here were these scuba divers out by Echo Point, I think it is, or one of the points over there. And they come back with a couple of rusty tin cans or something. We couldn't find anything. So one of the art instructors had a small rowboat, and they have by the corner of the kill in the pottery room, they have all these pieces of pottery that didn't quite come out, and they're just being weighted to all of the dumps. So anyway, we took them out in the rowboat and just scattered them all around Alki Point out there in the water, and then waited a couple weekends and went out, and God, these guys were having the best time and coming back with all these great artifacts.
Ruins of ancient civilizations.
Nations. And so I started making what they call press molds. You just take a piece of plaster of Paris and scratch in it, and I was making things that looked like this, that, and the other thing, and ancient coins and blah, blah. And then when the grandkids would come over, I'd give them the clay, and they'd press those all out for me. And then when I fired my enamels, I'd cook, and we made thousands of these things. And then when we'd go on trips, we'd leave them in flower boxes along the highway, put them on window ledges where people couldn't see them. And we were in Australia, and I'd taken a bunch over there, and came across a dig, and the archaeologists were, and it says, do not remove artifacts. But it didn't say anything about leaving them, so we left a hand. And then I believe in vandal art, too. And there's out there where you walk to see the painted rocks. Uh-huh. There's rocks out there that, with a little sensitivity, you could just make that into this magnificent place with all these funny pile up rocks, but of course you can't do that. It's public property. Some kids might fall over and get hurt and sue everybody in the site. But so it needs a vandal art. And there's a couple of bridge abutments in the river I would like to organize some. I got plenty of people who are interested, but I lack the backbone and the backup of lawyers.
The late artist Harold Belaise with Vern Windham in 2010. Who says art has to be serious? Rest in peace, Uncle Harold. Thank you for your support of Inland Journal and Spokane Public Radio, and thank you for your comments and story ideas. Send them to inlandjournal@kpbx.org or call our listener line at 509-232-6904. I'm Doug Nadvornik. See you next week.